Welcome to the Pause Purpose Play podcast with me, clinical psychologist Michaela Thomas. This podcast is for you if you're an ambitious working woman wanting to create more impact in the world with less impact on yourself. This is where we let go of the pressure of perfection for more joy, compassion, and connection in your life so you can burn bright, not burn out. Welcome back to the Pause Purpose Play podcast with me, Michaela Thomas. In this episode, we're going to cover something that may sound really dreary based on the episode title, but it's actually the title of the book of the author I'm interviewing today, a relationship coach. So if you're in a relationship with someone, a male partner perhaps, who doesn't quite get it when you're upset about something, or they may try to fix it and it makes you feeling worse. Maybe it leaves you feeling invalidated or having to ramp up and express even more while you're upset about something, then this episode is for you, but it's also for him. So why does Pause Purpose Play matter when it comes to our relationships? Well, as you know, I wrote the book The Lasting Connection, How to Develop Love and Compassion for Yourself and Your Partner, and I thought a lot about my signature system, Pause Purpose Play, there too. We need to pause for long enough to notice what is going on in our own emotions, what's going on in our own thoughts, and then also be able to direct that awareness outwardly to our partner to notice what's going on for them. That takes a lot of presence. And we need to pause because otherwise we become so reactive and just lash out or become defensive. So when we learn to slow things down and pause, we can sit with it. That means we can then behave like the person we want to be in our partnership, more in line with our values, our purpose, our meaning. Then life opens up. When you're able to sit with your partner's emotions, when you're able to build trust and connection, life gets more fun. You get more spontaneous, you have a deeper connection, and that's the playfulness. Because then you've built a safe place in your relationship, where it's safe to be silly and safe to open up and be vulnerable. It's a lot more playful. So in today's episode with Matthew Frey, we're going to talk about the 10,000 paper cuts that actually erode that trust, that severs that connection, and is not the big, massive things you think it is that will end your marriage. This relationship episode isn't just for you if you're married, but also if you are cohabiting with someone or in a very long-term committed relationship. Matthew Frey is a relationship coach and author who leans on the lessons of his own failed marriage and divorce to help others avoid making the same mistakes that he did. His book, This Is How Your Marriage Ends, went out in 2022 and is the book that I often recommend to my male partners. Matt first got noticed when he wrote a blog post around how his wife left him because he left dishes by the sink. Now, it wasn't really about the dishes, and we're going to talk more about that in the episode. It is about what the dishes mean. It is about the repeated invalidation and eroding of trust that is the death of a relationship. Let's dive in. So welcome to the podcast, Matt. It's such an honor to talk to you because, like I said earlier, my nightstand has had the joy of having your book on it for quite a while, and I've been absorbing it and mentioning it to my partner. And as a fellow couples therapist as well, I know you do coaching for couples, I think it's such a good resource. So I'm very glad to dive deeper into this conversation today about how we can find more validation for our partners. So tell the story of how this all began, you know, that one blog post that changed everything for you. Let's start there.
It's really nice to be here. Thank you for having me. At the time of this recording, we're almost exactly 10 years removed from the story of my wife, like driving away with her son in the backseat. And that was on April 1st, 2013. I had such a difficult time with my personal life falling apart like that. And in the summer, somebody convinced me to write. You know, like write my feelings, so to speak. And that manifested into a blog, which over time accidentally turned into a self-reflective personal journey on the end of my marriage and trying to better understand relationships, trying to understand how I got from point A to point B, what I could have done differently. And it ended up, I don't know, becoming something that people were paying attention to. So about 3 years in, I wrote this article randomly during my lunch break at work called "She Divorced Me Because I Left Dishes by the Sink." And it was like 10 other blog posts that I'd already written. This one, I think, just had like the right combination of like title and substance. But it was in January 2016. I think it was in February 2016 when like it sort of went nuts and was far and away the most popular thing I'd ever written, and remains to this day the most popular thing I've ever written. And I think it presents a really good conversation around what people are allowed to care about relationally and how things that present really small can magnify a dynamic between two people that will cause one or both of them to eventually not want to be in the relationship anymore. I got so many emails and so many blog comments from people saying this created a conversation. I had women thanking me for taking responsibility for it. I had a lot of people wanting to very literally talk about dishes, even though I think it's an infinitely deeper subject matter than whether we leave dishes by the sink or not. And then I had guys angrily writing me that I'd caused fights in their relationship, that everything was fine until my article showed up and their wife or girlfriend got upset with them. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Really fascinating of how many different levels you were helpful and in some people's views unhelpful, because it started that conversation that this is not just about the dishes by the sink, but is what they represent, the meaning we put into that. The phrase you use in the book, which I think is fantastic, is the sort of the death of the 1,000 or 10,000 paper cuts, how this is such a slow burn of invalidation and eroding of that trust. Can we start there of why was this the end of your marriage? Why did your wife drive off in the car with your kid in the back?
There's no way to encapsulate the entirety of our relationship in one moment. I think that's the real danger of what happens to, I believe, most relationships, this notion that we die slowly. We, the couple, die slowly, because any isolated incident doesn't raise a red flag. It doesn't sound the alarm that there's a huge problem. It really feels like, and often too, I hate the gender stereotype, I really do, because it's not always like the way that it is, certainly, but I would say like observably, it's sort of true mathematically most of the time. Right. And I usually have male-female relationships, and generally the male partner is the one engaged in the sort of behavior I was engaged in my relationship in terms of what I encounter from a coaching standpoint. It's always like the same story. It's like he can go to sleep, wake up the next day, and everything's fine. And if repair didn't happen, and that is a word and a concept relationally, it took 7-8 years. And I have to give credit to Terry Real for like really helping me see this notion of repair and how critical it is, and thinking of these like little micro transactions that we have in our relationships as something that needs repaired if we're mindful about it. I don't think most young people that get into relationships think of these so-called little things as something that needs to be fixed, because it doesn't qualify as a problem. What qualifies as a problem is the accumulation of unrepaired moments of disrespect, of invalidation, of an absence of consideration, something that inadvertently communicates, I don't care for you, I don't respect you, I value what I think and feel over what you think and feel. Push comes to shove, if there's conflict between what you think and feel versus what I think and feel, I choose me. That is the unintended consequence of these little things that go unrepaired in relationships. And I did that as effectively, if you will, unknowingly in my marriage, as I constantly communicated, I choose me over you. And I don't really know how to say it better than that. Whether it was an argument over the caliber of a movie we just watched, or how to do something, or like what activity we're going to go do on a Saturday afternoon, or whether I wanted to go spend time with her parents, you know, on a Sunday for dinner, and rather than stay home and watch a sporting event or something. There are so many little moments of conflict where I simply chose my values over hers and then failed to understand the consequences of that long term.
So that accumulation of this buildup of each little event that were all pointing in that direction, that you don't matter to me as much as my own choices. And it's really difficult then to kind of hearing that and reflecting on that. And I'm sorry about the 10-year anniversary, because that might be painful as well to think about that. But you've done what a lot of my guests on the podcast has done, which is finding some sort of purpose in their pain. And that's not an easy thing to do. This led to you training as a coach to help other couples. How did that come about?
Very accidental, very organic. I was writing all these articles on the internet. I was sort of accidentally turning into, I don't want to say thought leader, like it sounds like I'm giving myself credit for it. I don't think I bring any thought leadership to the table so much as I was saying it in a way that landed with people. I was saying similar things that many other smarter, wiser, more learned human beings have been saying for decades. I just sort of found a tone and an audience that resonated with it. It was like Matt's way of saying it makes sense to me. In a way, other people saying it didn't make sense to me. But finally, people started asking, hey, why don't you help me? Why don't you literally work with me one-on-one and coach me? And I was highly, highly hesitant to do that. But that in conjunction, I don't know if you're familiar with a man named Mark Groves in the United States, but he's brilliant. He runs an organization called Create the Love. He's an excellent podcaster and a really good guy. And somehow found my way on the phone with him. I don't even know how it happened. I think he just volunteered to spend a little time talking to me because he'd come across my blog before. He was the one. I have to give him all the credit. He was the one that really pushed me. He did it two different times. He did it once. I didn't do anything about it. A year later, I was on the phone with him one more time. And in his sort of mentorship role, he's like, Matt, you have to do it. That's the way to turn a side project hobby into something that you might be able to turn into what you spend your life doing. And that was what I was trying to do. It's like, how can I make this a job? And that was his best advice. And then one thing led to another and it has turned into that.
You write so beautifully in your book about how to make that message and the heart pill accessible and to realize that. So I wonder if we can think a little bit about what you write about invalidation as a way of eroding trust and the different levels of invalidation. Can we think about that?
It's a couple of things. I think it's sort of sneakily the biggest problem in relationships. What's interesting is to me, it doesn't come first. Like an incident occurs that causes a problem for one or both relationship partners. And then it's what happens during the conversation around that incident is where I think love and trust die. And we don't notice it as it's happening. And I'm so glad that you talked about this idea of, I don't get to decide what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong. I don't perceive myself to have the moral authority to do that. But if we're all going to like grant a little liberty to use the word good to all generally mean somebody that like causes no harm and you'd leave your kids with them for a couple of hours because they're a good person, that kind of thing. Like that's who I mean. People that are smart and they don't commit crimes and they don't do anything sort of overtly harmful and their intentions are absolutely in the right place, generally speaking, in terms of what they perceive to be good, bad, right, wrong. They're good people. And I think one of the most critical ideas is that good people can be very bad, air quotes, at relationships. They can be very bad relationship partners and they can cause immeasurable pain and immeasurable harm to you. And it has nothing to do with their character. And the reason I like to talk about that idea, because defensiveness is such a massive component of this invalidation sort of cycle that happens relationally. And I was so defensive, and so many of the men that I work with are so defensive based on the idea that they didn't do anything wrong, that they didn't mean to cause any harm. Therefore, they shouldn't be thought of or criticized or treated this way. And it's amazing how we turn ourselves into the victim relationally. So I like to tell this story in the first person, this thing about invalidation. I want people to hear it. I want people to say, wow, this is exactly what I do in my relationship as well, because I want them to notice. I want them to think of this as inadvertently harmful. It seems like I'm disagreeing with another adult, which I should be allowed to do. And I'm suggesting that it disguises itself as that. What the other person is experiencing, despite our best intentions, is having their lived experience invalidated. And I think the simplest way to think about it is that they're having a problem and they're trying to recruit you to help them solve the problem or at minimum, like let you know about it. And it doesn't go well for them. The results of the conversation where I'm trying to let you know I'm having a problem and ask you for help is total rejection. And that's what I did to my wife. And I think a lot of people inadvertently do this in their relationship. So it's this thing I call the invalidation triple threat. And the thing that happens is nobody's problem ever gets solved. We always communicate, sorry, I don't agree there's a problem. Therefore, you're on your own to take care of it. The three ways we invalidate people in our relationships. Version one, my wife would come to me and she would say, hey, Matt, something's wrong. A bad thing happened. I feel bad about it. And the first way that I frequently would invalidate my wife is I would disagree that what she was describing or the event that she was characterizing had happened as it did. I would just fundamentally disagree that her description of what had occurred, it wasn't what I experienced. And I think it's important to think about it that way because we really do believe different things than the other person. And it doesn't seem wrong to challenge someone's completely different perception of whatever occurred. But what is wrong in the context of safety and trust and love and care, and intimacy and connection and relationships is to always communicate, sorry, I don't care about your pain. I don't care about your problem. You can't rely on me to help with it. And that's what I communicated to my wife. I said, wait a minute, that's not even what happened. I treated her as if the bad she was experiencing was irrelevant because it was based on something that didn't even occur. That's what happened over and over and over again. Version two just flips this idea like in reverse. My wife would come to me and say, hey, Matt, a bad thing happened. I feel bad about it. And this time I would agree that the bad thing occurred. I would agree that the incident happened, but I would disagree that how she felt about it was fair or appropriate or commiserate with like the level of bad that the incident was. I usually accuse my wife of overreacting, making a bigger deal out of something than necessary. And so the implication was, sure, that happened, but why are you making such a big deal about this? So in version one, where something's wrong with the way she's thinking about it, I think the cynical implication, I didn't mean to imply this, but I implied this. You're wrong, you're dumb, or you're crazy. Think of the three things we inadvertently communicate when we challenge someone else's intellectually experienced. They lived through this. They're pretty sure they know what happened and we're challenging it. Like wrong, stupid, crazy. Version two, my wife was weak. She was dramatic. She was hypersensitive. She was overreacting. There was always something wrong with what she thought. There was always something wrong with what she felt. And that is what I communicated to her over and over and over again. And then I mentioned defensiveness earlier. That is the third way we invalidate people, I think, most often. There are other versions of this. These are, to me, the big three. Somebody says, hey, Matt, you did something. It hurt me. And I'm like, wait a minute. If you just understand the situation I was dealing with and what I thought and what I was intending to do, then I won't be in trouble anymore. I won't be the bad guy. The common denominator in all three of these responses is everything I think and feel matters a lot to me. And everything you think and feel is of little consequence to me if it's in conflict with what I think and feel. I choose me over you. This is the unintended consequence of invalidating your relationship partner. I like to tell people, you can get by just fine with your childhood friends, with your coworkers, with your siblings, with a lot of people. You can get by. These relationships won't necessarily fall apart and die. I don't think they'll thrive, but it won't kill you. This dynamic will absolutely destroy love and trust between relationship partners. And I think also between parents and children sometimes. There's only really two ideas I coach about in my work. And this is the first one. The first one is, can you get invalidating responses out of your life, out of your mouth, out of your brain? When somebody tells you there's a problem, can you help them heal, repair, fix, whatever word you want to use? Can you help them like fix the problem rather than, and I don't mean it in the way where like men are so inclined to try to like fix other people's problems. This requires a nuanced touch and it requires emotional intelligence that I didn't have during my 13-year relationship with my former spouse.
Hello, busy working woman. I've got news for you. There is a way where you can burn bright without burning out. There is a way where you can discover how to calm the overwhelm and create more ease and peace in your work and in your life. I want you to watch the replay of my free masterclass for ambitious female entrepreneurs, founders, CEOs, senior corporate women, and if you're wanting to create more impact in the world with less impact on yourself, this talk is for you. So let me see if this resonates with you. You're an ambitious female entrepreneur working hard to reach your goals, but it's taken a toll on your well-being. You can't remember the last time you properly switched off on a holiday without worrying about your business or the work to-do list. Your body is telling you to slow down, but you've got too much to do to listen, so you push through with more coffee or sugar. You worry about what other people think, or you second-guess your decisions, or procrastinate something until it's perfect. Well, then this talk is for you. Let's find you balance over burnout so you can reach your stretch your goals without becoming overstretched. Go to thethomasconnection.lpages.co/burnbright. That's thethomasconnection.lpages.co/burnbright to catch this free replay of my masterclass. I'll put the link in the show notes as well, so it's just easier for you to click it and watch it in your own time. And now back to the episode.
How do you sit with male partners helping them to tap into their emotions and getting buy-in to do that? How do you get them to want to be more emotionally expressive and explore how to validate properly?
It's a little complicated sometimes when you find, I don't want to use scary words like sociopathy or narcissism, because those get thrown around a lot. And I'm not convinced that that's as prevalent as people say, but I also don't think it matters. I always tell the guys that I'm working with, I didn't have to be sociopathic and I didn't have to be a narcissist to speak and act in a manner that my wife felt that experience she had would have been identical to if she had been with a sociopath or a narcissist. Like, what's the difference?
Like the same behavior.
And so, right, it's the same. Let me just give like a very specific real world example of this. And I think you'll understand this on a trauma level that I don't, but I've got a couple of guys that have seen combat, right? They're former special forces operatives in the United States military, and they've seen and done things that are unimaginable to me, unimaginable. They've seen horror and they've had people they love die next to them. And then they come home and their wife wants to argue about a dish by the sink and they have a really hard time taking that seriously. And I understand that. I really truly do. And I talk to them about that. So like you ask the right question, I think it's tricky. The best thing I know how to do is to try to tap into some empathetic response. My most commonly asked question is, can you share with me a time in which you felt pain? Not physical, I got cut, I got burned, I got hit. Where you felt pain because of some incident that occurred in your life. Deep, invisible, emotional pain. Something broke. And sometimes they can't. Often they can. And then we get to work on relativism because I think it matters. There's a lot of absolute truthers in the world that believe in this idea of, well, these things are true and these things are false and these things are right and these things are wrong. They base all of their sort of values and life decisions on that. And to me, that's a very dangerous mindset for respecting diverse thought and emotional experiences from our own. It makes us, I think, ill-equipped to navigate healthy relationships if we're going to always assume that the things we think and feel are somehow universally better or truer than what someone else thinks and feels. It's just this core belief that I know what's true, I know what's right, I know what's fair. Therefore, any challenge to that can't be those things. Did what you do inadvertently inflict pain on the other person? And doesn't it make sense for a person who's hurt over and over again, even if it's by accident, doesn't it make sense for them to withdraw, for them to maybe not want to be in a relationship with you anymore? But nonetheless, when we're trapped in this sort of like, we're a good guy mindset, it's very difficult for us to agree that the dish by the sink is as harmful as, you know, our relationship partners claiming it is.
What do you think now, Matt, that obviously there's 10 years since your relationship ended, what realizations have you had that has helped you kind of to the future from your own divorce?
The word awareness may be the most important word to me in relationships. Mindfulness, to me, they mean the same thing. I am aware today that various things I do, whether it's a one-off incident because I was thoughtless or whether it's a pattern of behavior that I happen to have. I'm ADHD and ADHD causes relationship problems. I want to be careful about that. It sounds like a crutch. It sounds like an excuse. People who are ADHD can often appear selfish and thoughtless to other people because of their impulsivity and because of the sort of lack of mindful clarity around how what they're doing or not doing might be impacting those around them. And it is the number one principle that I try to coach on. Everything surrounding the word consideration is to me the most important concept in relationships, right? I'm not a therapist, so I can't help heal. There's tons of things that people need to heal within themselves. And I'm not equipped to help people do that necessarily, other than hopefully help gently guide them toward the people who can. My work is about awareness. I am today very aware that things I do and things I say can inadvertently roll downhill and cause harm to other people. I would equate it to, I invited 10 people over for dinner. I'm making a Thai dish with peanut sauce. And I forgot to ask everybody if they have a peanut allergy. And it turns out one of the 10 does. And that wasn't very considerate of that person. But they're not mad at me. They don't think I'm a bad person. They don't think I'm a jerk. They're just like, I'm left out. I don't get to have dinner with everybody else tonight. But what happens when I invite those same 10 people over five more times? And every single time I'm putting out dishes of peanuts or otherwise having things that are poisonous to them in these dishes that I'm serving, like, at what point are they going to wonder whether they should be investing in me, whether they should be spending time with me, whether the sum of my actions communicates to them that I care about them and that I respect them? At some point, you're either doing things to deliberately harm others, or you care so little for them that you don't take steps to protect them from potential injury. And this is the conclusion that our spouses or relationship partners come to over time. My partner's either doing this on purpose because he doesn't or she doesn't care about me, or I can't trust them to look out for me. They seem ill-equipped or unwilling to do the work of protecting me from injury just because it's not something that affects them. And that is me in a nutshell. That was me. And it's not now. Now I am mentally vigilant about protecting those I love from my blind spots to the best of my ability. And when I do slip up, so to speak, and do something that was thoughtless, I'm pretty effective at communicating it. Nobody's walking away from the conversation saying, Matt's a threat to continue doing that over and over and over again. And that is the difference between me today and me and my marriage. There was no awareness on my part that I wasn't accepting responsibility for protecting those I love, specifically my wife, from certain forms of injury. I always communicated, you can count on me next week, next month, next year to keep doing the same things I'm doing right now, because there's nothing wrong with me. There's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with the way you think. There's something wrong with the way you feel, and you're misjudging me. This is on you, not me. Those were the messages, intentionally or otherwise, that I was sending in all of my conversations with her.
It sounds like, without paraphrasing too much, it sounds like you having this perspective, pausing for long enough to consider, how did my action affect another human being, my former spouse included, can then help you take compassionate action to do something about it, to be helpful rather than harmful. So I guess that's a really valuable lesson to bring into your coaching, the lived experiences you've had and the mistakes we made. And this is, I guess, why multiple times throughout your book, there comes this notion of, and this is how your marriage ends, or this is how your relationship ends if you're not married, in a way that came too late for you. Over the last decade, have you had any other significant relationships where you've tried to implement these realizations from your divorce?
I think my relationship that's been impacted the most, if we're not going to count my ex-wife, because we've had a dramatic transformation between she and I think there's an enormous amount of trust between the two of us now. And I'm so grateful for it. I think she really understands. And as a parent to our son, who is a 14-year-old version of me, which is to say he's exactly like me because I act 14, it's the same. She has so much more compassion and perspective around my behavioral tendencies in our marriage because he deals with the ADHD that I did. And it can come off really selfish. And it's often not. It's thoughtless, which some people, it's synonymous with selfish. And it really, in a way, is. But as he matures, he's going to become aware of how this thoughtlessness that he has inadvertently impacts other people. And so in my parent-child relationship, I'm so much more of an effective father, both in terms of how I navigate like my day-to-day with him. But I think most importantly, when we get to talk about life lessons, I do not shy away from stories that say, Bud, this is why we don't live together anymore. And I'm like, I realize this seems so petty and so like not a very big deal to you. And he's so good about listening and he's so good about caring because he really doesn't want to cause harm. And so like that easily, the father-son relationship, again, both in terms of how I react to him and in terms of my ability to speak words that are going to be hopefully serve him well in his future adult relationships. And then in my dating life, I don't know, I spent the first half of these 10 years, just, I don't know, casual is the word, but they weren't long-term, serious, committed relationships. I see somebody, it's just her, and it's been that way for a while. And I think this is the first time I've even really talked about it publicly. I think that I'm probably in a relationship that, it'll end by surprise if it ends, I would say at this point. What's interesting, and I talk to all my clients about this a lot. I don't know if you recall from the book, but I think about trust. The way that I visualize trust in relationships is to imagine two dots on a horizontal line, one dot representing one partner and the second dot representing the other, and they start close together. But then there's a distance that develops over time as these paper cut incidents pile up, as repair doesn't happen because of these little mini conflicts that occur that pile up over months and years together. The lesson I think that I've really, really picked up from what I do is that it's very easy, in my estimation, with a lot of awareness and discipline, to keep the dots close from day one. It's very difficult to repair dots that are far apart. And you have 15, 20 years of infractions, if you will, of inadvertent harm caused. The amount of time you have to behave differently in order to inspire confidence and trust from the other person is intense when there's been decades of pain. And people don't always come back from that. It's not scary for two people who should be going separate ways to go separate ways. But in the context of like how they thought about it when they first got together, these people could have made it. These people could have made it and they didn't know better. They didn't know how to have the conversation. They didn't know how to apply mindfulness habits around how what I'm doing and measuring its impact on the other person. These things are lost on so many people. And sometimes it takes something painful and shocking and life-changing to make you rethink your belief system. That's what it did for me. I would love to be the kind of person that can help people before they develop these problems and or like learn how to repair them. And I absolutely think it's possible. Some people won't choose it. Some people will say, let's say a hurt wife and mother, for example, for 15 years straight, will say, he's really changed. And I'm really proud of him. And I really wish he'd done it, started, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago when I first asked him to, because then I think we'd have a chance. We don't. There's been too much harm.
Yeah, it's a tough pill to swallow, isn't it? All these things that we have to do, holding up a mirror to our own faces and look at our own patterns and behaviors. I wonder, and please, Matt, tell me if this is too personal as well. Did you have your ADHD diagnosis when this happened, or did that come after the divorce?
After. We didn't have context for ADHD in our marriage. That would have been really useful, but I don't like to use it as a crutch or an excuse. It's not one. My brain is a certain way. I am prone to sort of be a little bit thoughtless sometimes because I might appear to not be as effective of a listener. I might be prone to short-term forgetfulness. You know, if you give me a list of four things, I'm a threat to come home from the store with only three of them. I told you about this Monday, and I'm like, no, you didn't. But she did. And my brain literally experienced it as her not. Those are all legitimate things that happened. I'm innocent of wrongdoing. The math result, the sum of my actions created pain in the relationship because they communicated that I don't respect, I don't value you, I don't consider you when I make decisions. You can't rely on me. I don't have your back, right? Like if my values conflict with your values, you can count on me choosing my values, what I want, my preference, over and over again. And then no awareness of how to navigate that relationally, of how to repair those moments. I was so busy being defensive, so busy trying to like sell her on the idea that she's just interpreting the world around us wrong, rather than, again, the peanut analogy is one of my favorite ones that I use constantly. My relationship partner, she's got a severe gluten allergy. I have to be very mindful about not inadvertently poisoning her with products that contain wheat. And I'm not bad because I might have a bready substance on my hand from time to time, but shouldn't she be able to trust me to not touch a loaf of bread and then rub my hand across her face? Yes, she'd be able to trust me to do that. And that's what the work's been about. These food allergy scenarios present such a good, to me, thought exercise for what it looks like to, you don't need to intend to cause harm to cause harm.
And it's actually, that's part of being in a couple's relationship is that you won't overlap on everything and you don't need to. You don't need to be compatible on all points, but you need to show compassion for the bits where you differ. And that's the bit that is the hardest when you're growing dynamically across a lifetime where things are changing and you are changing. So just following along that journey together, it's really difficult, isn't it? So it sounds like there's been a lot of compassion pieces that could have been helpful for you to have that awareness. So again, come back to awareness being so key, having the awareness about your brain being differently wired. That is not your fault. but it's also not your wife's fault that she's living with someone whose brain is differently wired. So when we're neurodiverse, it's even more important, I think, to have compassion for how hard it is to live this way and how hard it is for someone to live with someone who is this way. So thank you very much for sharing that. I know it's a personal thing, and I'm also extending a piece of compassion to your ex-wife. If she ever listens to any of your interviews, then sending a piece of compassion to her as well, because she's been part of this journey of you tapping from pain into purpose and thinking about, how do I help other people not make the mistakes I made? And that's, I think it's a very generous gift that you give to people, that you so openly talk about your shortcomings and flaws and mistakes in a way that becomes a lesson for other people to read. So thank you so much for writing that, specifically also for all the male partners who don't necessarily want to go to therapy or don't want to do this work. Actually, reading your book makes them have to face that. So thank you very much for writing that book. Is there anything final you want to give as a gift to the listeners, either permission to give them or a pressure to take off them?
I don't like to be so repetitive, but I think it's the most important idea that there is, this idea of mindfulness. I want people to detach their own character and their own intentions and how they think of themselves and who they want and try to be in the world from what actually happens. I had the best intentions in the world. I truly did. I absolutely, philosophically, emotionally felt love for my relationship partner. And I lacked awareness and skills necessary to communicate that to her, period. I was fundamentally unaware of it. I think so many of our hangups, and you'll know this better than I, so many of our hangups revolve around our identities and this idea that we're good, this idea that we're misjudged or that we're being rejected or mistreated or misunderstood. And if we can just like detach character and intention from this, it's peanuts. Peanuts can kill people, and peanuts are delicious snacks for most of us. And it's the same for the things that we do or don't do, the things we say or don't say in our relationship. Once in a while, under the right set of circumstances, they can cause immeasurable harm to other people, to people that we love. And the work has to become about protecting them from that injury instead of whatever it is that we get lost in, like within ourselves. Can we like give ourselves permission to be good people who still are a threat to hurt others, and then protect them, use that good within us to want to protect other people? And if we make it about them and not about us, really good things will happen. And that to me is the mindset shift that I've made and that I really want to encourage other people to think about. If they're really subscribed to this, I'm a good person, he or she should give me credit for being a good person. This is another way you can be a good person, is to visually protect the emotional experiences of other people, even when they're different than your own.
Thank you so much from a lot, Matt. It's a really, really helpful conversation of this hard pill to swallow. And again, we weren't taught this in school. So no wonder that we will all struggle, and we need to sort of find ways to repair when we make a mistake and we mess up on this. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a joy to have you on.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to the end of this episode. I really hope it was useful. And I hope that you share that with your partner as well. Remember that you can get more help if you need to develop your compassionate mind and help your partner develop their compassionate mind. My online course, The Compassionate Couple, is available on demand whenever you need it. Just go to thethomasconnection.co.uk/The Compassionate Couple. And if you are a keen listener of this podcast, pop me an email on info@thethomasconnection.co.uk and I'll give you a 20% off discount code. And until I speak to you next time, do take care of yourself and take care of your partner too. Thank you so much for listening to the end of this episode of the Pause, Purpose, Play podcast with me, Michaela Thomas. If you found this episode helpful, make sure that you hit that follow or subscribe button to not miss the next episode. Tell other people about this podcast, because together we can change the world and be more kind, caring and compassionate to ourselves as well as other people. And as always, do take care of yourself. Until I see you next week.